So, if, like me, your introduction to the suffragette movement was as a kid watching Mary Poppins, we were actually presented with a fairly accurate picture of the suffragette movement in Britain in the early 20th century, to which this presentation will be focusing on. So, if you remember early on, the mother, referred to only as Mrs. Banks, returns from a suffragette rally, beaming that one of her fellow suffragettes had chained herself to the Prime Minister's carriage, something that was actually attempted in the real struggle. And she then proceeds to break into song. I don't know if people here remember the song? Yes? Yes? Well, unfortunately for you, I'm still going to sing a bit of it anyway. Okay, so it starts out, we're clearly soldiers in petticoats, dauntless crusaders for women's votes. And though we adore men individually, as a group, we must admit they're rather stupid. I mean, the song. So political equality and equal rights with men. Take heart, for Mrs. Pankhurst has been clapped in irons again. Well done, sister suffragettes. So there you go. That's the little spiel that happened at the beginning of Mary Poppins. So we have Mrs. Banks, the wife of a banker, middle class, well off, singing about women's rights to votes with her three female servants. So the other women, who were not able to go to the suffragette rally because they were working, would also not be granted the right to vote under the suffragettes' plan for equal rights, which meant voting rights on the same terms as men, which itself did not include the majority of working-class men. So Mrs. Banks was the archetypal suffragette, and while she called her servants sisters, they had very little in common with each other. So the presentation today, as I said before, will be focusing on the suffragette movement and its leadership in Britain from its heyday of the early 1900s to just after World War I. Of course, there were suffragette movements all across the world, including America, here in Australia and in New Zealand. But the most celebrated and notorious of that was of the women of Britain. So the notoriety of the suffragette campaign mostly came from their militancy. Women went on hunger strikes, burnt down buildings, threw rocks at members of parliament, spat at police, and were willing to put their lives on the line for their cause. But while their actions were brave, their politics, unfortunately, were conservative. In a time where voting rights were restricted to a minority of men, the demand for voting rights on equal terms with men disenfranchised not only the majority of women, but also the majority of men. The middle-class leadership of the movement was not interested in women's liberation. They were interested in maintaining the privileges of the upper classes. They were hostile to the demands of the mass of the working class. And at the first true test of their politics, at the outbreak of World War I, they dropped all demands for women's rights to vote altogether and 110% threw themselves behind supporting their government in the mass slaughter that was World War I. So how radical were the suffragettes? So I'm going to argue that it's your politics which make you radical. Do you support the status quo or do you want to challenge it? Do you support the working class or the ruling class, the latter of which exploit and disenfranchise the majority every day? Do you have an orientation to the mass of people to change society? On all these counts, the suffragettes were not really radical at all. At a time when there was not even universal male suffrage, the suffragettes campaigned for votes for a minority of women only, and counterposed their campaign to that of universal suffrage for all adults, something which the Labour parties and socialist groups at the time were campaigning for. So I will be focusing on the WSPU, the Women's Social and Political Union, and they were the dominant suffragette organisation during this period. There were other groups, both before and after, but this was the organisation that had the most impact. The dominant figures within the WSPU were the Pankhurst women, Emmeline and her daughters Christabel and Sylvia. These women and their politics will also be a focus of this talk. So the growth of the movement for women's suffrage can be seen in the context of the growing role women were playing in society. Women workers were coming to the fore during new unionism, where previously unorganised sections of workers began to form trade unions. There was waves of strikes led by largely unskilled and unorganised workers beginning in 1889. And between 1900 and 1914, the number of women involved in trade unions tripled. And women played prominent roles in the campaign for shorter hours in textile factories and also in the shop steward movement. And middle-class women as well were coming up against the old ways. They were owning property, going to university, and their expectations about the role that they could play in society were being raised. So Emmeline Pankhurst, the first woman I mentioned, was the founder of the WSPU. She was born into a political family, a self-described suffragist from the age of 14. She was involved in many political activities. She joined the Independent Labour Party, which was a parliamentary party associated with the trade unions, and campaigned around women's working conditions. She became increasingly frustrated with the slow pace of reform for women's votes and critical of the suffragist organisations which did exist, like the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies, the NUWSS, which saw lobbying politicians and, you know, the polite and ladylike ways of convincing politicians to allow the vote, of course, only for propertied women. So in 1903, Emmeline, along with her eldest daughter Christabel, founded the Women's Social and Political Union. The Daily Mail at the time dubbed the new organisation the Suffragettes, and this is where the term comes from, intended as a derogatory term, but the organisation immediately took up the name to separate themselves from the previous campaigners for women's rights to votes, which were known as the suffragists, and I'll be referring to them as well throughout the talk. Sylvia Pankhurst, while not initially playing a leading role in the organisation, became a prominent figure because of her organising amongst working class women. Eventually, Sylvia would leave the WSPU to form her own organisation because of the increasingly individualistic and right-wing politics of the suffragettes. So the aim of the WSPU was to win votes for women on the same terms as men. And this meant women who fulfilled the property qualification, i.e. they owned a business or paid a certain amount of rent, they were over 30 and unmarried or went to university. And these demands were not different from the other suffragist organisations as well. They were demanding votes for women on the same terms as men. But what made the WSPU different from other organisations for women's suffrage before it was its militancy, its willingness to take direct action to reach its goals. It inspired women, both working class and middle class, to take up the cause. In fact, the WSPU really started to gain support and national attention after its first act of militancy. So this was in October in 1905. Sir Edward Grey, the Liberal shadow foreign secretary, spoke at the Manchester Free Trades Hall. Now, the Liberals, they're not as the Liberals we know today. They're more like smaller Liberals. They were progressive in their own way. And as he was speaking, Christabel Pankhurst and Annie Kenny, who was also a member of the WSPU, stood up and unfurled banners saying votes for women. They interrupted Sir Edward Grey. They demanded to know what a Liberal government would do for the emancipation of women. And this was quite something, not only because, you know, a prominent political figure was interrupted, but it was a woman interrupting a man. So this gained a lot of attention. They were evicted from the hall and then arrested when they tried to hold a meeting outside. They refused to pay the fines and went to prison. Annie for 3 days and Christabel for 7 because she spat at a policeman. So this was the first in a series of acts of civil disobedience that would make the suffragettes notorious. The WSPU grew rapidly into a nationwide force after this. Its direct action tactics caught the imagination of large numbers of women, and the landslide election of a Liberal government later that year raised hopes that votes for women would be granted. However, these hopes were quickly dashed. The Liberals refused to put up a bill for votes for women, and so the suffragettes began hounding Liberal cabinet ministers and disrupting their meetings. Mass arrests just further swelled the movement. When the Liberals scraped back into government for a second term in 2010 and still refused to budge on the question of votes for women, the suffragettes turned to more militant tactics, such as smashing windows and starting fires. Jailed suffragettes repeatedly went on hunger strike and many were brutally force-fed to break their protest. So the high point of the campaign came in 1908. The WSPU called a demonstration for the vote in Hyde Park and contingents came from all over Britain. The expected turnout was about a quarter of a million, but it was more like 750,000 women. And between May and November of 1910, over 4,000 peaceful demonstrations and public meetings had been held. And so in 1911, this was enough pressure on the government that it seemed like a bill would finally be passed allowing a minority of women to vote. And the WSPU saw this as a victory. But at the last moment, the Prime Minister Asquith, who was religiously against women's rights to vote, withdrew the bill, infuriating even the most moderate of suffragists and their Liberal supporters. So the suffragettes' actions became more focused on individualist actions, focusing on the destruction of property and grabbing headlines, not mobilising its supporters. By 1913, mass activity in the form of public meetings and demonstrations almost entirely ceased to exist. Instead, the suffragettes' frustration at continued defeat escalated the attacks on private property and members of parliament. So included in the many militant acts, some are a bit interesting, but in the absence of a, you know, campaign to mobilise your supporters, happened in vain. So some of these militant acts were the burning of churches, restaurants and railway carriages, the smashing government windows happened weekly, cutting telephone lines, spitting at police and politicians, partial destruction of David Lloyd George's home, the cutting and burning of pro-suffragette slogans into lawn turf. Their favourite target was a golf course that was frequented by the rich and powerful. Sending letter bombs, destroying greenhouses at Kew Gardens, chaining themselves to railings and blowing up houses. And a doctor who was particularly anti-women's right to vote was attacked with a rhino whip. And in one case, suffragettes rushed the House of Lords in an attempt to occupy it. So, yes, while all very interesting, unfortunately it began to lead to the generation of the suffragettes as an organisation that was willing to mobilise its members in the fight for women's right to vote. And the government, in response to this in 1913, passed the Temporary Discharges of Prisoners Act, and it was known as the Cat and Mouse Act, which allowed the authorities to release prisoners who were weakened by their hunger strikes, which were majority were suffragettes, only to rearrest them when they had made a recovery. Now, this act by the government only served to win suffragettes more public support, as it was widely hated by the public. So the courage of the suffragettes should not be in doubt. But courage, while indispensable on its own, does not win struggles. For that, you need the right politics. And the movement contained a number of political weaknesses from the very beginning, which opened up cracks in its ranks, led to many splits, and led to the WSPU eventually to support World War I. So early on the history in the WSPU, Christabel began to abandon any notion of representing women beyond her own class, calling women workers the weakest section of the sex. Christabel defined the aims of the WSPU in this way. Ours is not a class movement at all. We take in everybody, the highest and the lowest, the richest and the poorest. The bond is womanhood, which is a bit rich considering that the campaign did not actually include the majority of women. So Emmeline and Christabel were increasingly autocratic, demanding complete loyalty and obedience from all who worked with them within the WSPU and breaking ties with their allies if this was not forthcoming, including abandoning all ties with the Labour Party. There was absolutely no internal democracy within the WSPU, which again reflected their class politics. And there was also the question of what they were fighting for. The WSPU wanted votes for women on the same basis as men. But at this time, 42% of men still did not have the right to vote. So such a demand excluded, as I said before, the majority of people in Britain. The WSPU slogan of Votes for Women was known by militant women trade unionists as Votes for the Ladies and repeatedly denounced. So the WSPU eventually completely split from its Labour roots. Christabel, in particular, made it clear that she had no loyalty to Labour and didn't care if the Tories got in. And the growing polarisation in society in the period leading up to the First World War, and especially the strike movement, known as the Great Unrest, brought matters to a head. So in this period leading up to the First World War, seamen and firemen went on strike and won. There was a series of strikes in the engineering industry, the ports were shut down by industrial action, and there was the first national rail strike. In fact, 20,000 troops were countermanded to the capital by the government because they feared revolution. And Emmeline and Christabel were completely unsympathetic to this mass uprising. Christabel argued that these men had the right to vote and should use that instead of going out on strike. Again, even though in reality only 42% of men actually had the right to vote. And Emmeline and Christabel actually ignored the large number of women workers who came out on strike as well, a militant movement which could have been harnessed behind the campaign for women's rights to vote. And revolutionary socialists at the time had sharp arguments with the upper and middle class feminists like Emmeline and Christabel who campaigned for votes for women. What is the aim of the feminists? Asked Alexandra Kollontai, a revolutionary in Russia during this period. She says, their aim is to achieve the same advantages, same power, the same rights within capitalist society as those possessed now by their husbands, fathers and brothers. What is the aim of the women workers? Their aim is to abolish all privileges deriving from birth or wealth. For a woman worker, it is a matter of indifference who is the master, a man or a woman. Revolutionary socialists argue that there could be no unity or sisterhood between rich and poor women. Again, Alexandra Kollontai. The paths pursued by women workers and bourgeois suffragettes have long since separated. There is too great a contradiction between the interests of the women worker and the lady proprietress, between the servant and the mistress. And it was about this time, in the lead up to World War I, that Sylvia took a very different path. As a committed socialist and activist, increasingly at odds with her mother and sister, she was eventually expelled from the WSPU. And this happened in 1913 after speaking in support of the locked out Dublin workers, one of the greatest causes of its day at a time when Ireland was still ruled from London. Sylvia supported the Irish and striking workers and believed that the fight for votes for women was not a struggle for women alone, but the entire working class. So she went on to found the East London Federation of Suffragettes, aimed at organising women workers and men, which over the years evolved politically and changed its name accordingly. First to Women's Suffrage Federation and then to the Workers' Socialist Federation. She founded the newspaper of the WSF, the Women's Dreadnought, which subsequently became the Workers' Dreadnought. It organised against the war when few organisations actually did, and some of its members hid conscientious objectors from the police. So, when the First World War began in 1914, Sylvia bitterly opposed it, whereas Christabel and Emmeline and the WSPU fell in behind the government's war effort. So before the war, the suffragettes had a verbal commitment to peace, as a lot of organisations around at this time did. Emmeline Pankhurst had previously stated, "War is not the women's way. To the women of this union, human life is sacred." However, in 1914, she wrote, "So ends in the present the war of women against men. As of the old, the women become the nurturing mothers of men, their sisters and uncomplaining helpmates, i.e. shut up and support the war." In fact, no organisation was as pro-war as the WSPU. Immediately, they suspended all political activity and told their supporters to endorse the government in its war effort. Instead of demonstrations for women's votes, they demonstrated for the war, began the practice of handing out white feathers to men who refused to fight, and even changed the name of their publication from the Suffragette to the Britannica. And its pages were now dedicated to supporting the war, no mention of women or their rights. And eventually the WSPU just became known as the Women's Party. So a few people have different interpretations of this history of the suffragettes. Those on the right look at the history and say that the militancy was a mistake, that it was the WSPU's support of the war is what convinced politicians to grant women the right to vote. They earned the right through their support of the war effort. And this is completely wrong. It was not their militancy, but their political strategy, which meant the vote was not won earlier. And the reaction to repeat setbacks and failures led them further to the right and away from the working class or mass mobilisation of their supporters. Not mobilising the increasing power of women workers and separating the question of women's rights to vote from the working class demand of universal adult suffrage meant that they were increasingly weak positioned to have any impact on the government. So just after the war in 1918, this is when propertied women over 30 who paid a certain amount in rent or went to university were granted the right to vote. And this is the fact that's used as proof, you know, just after the war had finished, the women had proven themselves worthy of the vote due to their support of the war. However, this leaves out the fact that the majority of women workers, those who had made the biggest contribution to the war effort, were not rewarded for their service during the war. A better explanation for the limited franchise being granted after the war was the fear governments around the world felt at the end of World War I of radical movements threatening their rule. The mass slaughter and deprivations of World War I had led to revolutionary movements all across the world, The British Army faced a series of mutinies. There was increased industrial action against the war. And it was women's workers' demands in 1917 that led to the overthrow of the Tsar and led to workers taking power in Russia. So extensions of voting rights to some women and more men were seen as a way to avoid similar social unrest, to divert the growing militancy by the world's working class population onto the parliamentary road. And Sylvia herself recognised this from the front lines, as a quote here from her book about why women were granted the vote in 1918. The memory of the old militancy and the certainty of its recurrence if the claims of women were set aside was a much stronger factor in overcoming the reluctance of those who would again have postponed the settlement, women's rights to vote. The shock to the foundations of existing social institutions already reverberating from Russia across Europe made many old opponents desire to enlist the new enthusiasm of women voters to stabilise the parliamentary machine. And in fact, it took until 1928 for women to win the vote without property restrictions on the exact same terms as men. However, despite the whole of the adult working class having the vote, improvements throughout history still had to be fought and won through the unions in the workplace, in struggles and on the streets. Clara Zetkin, a revolutionary from Germany, had this to say about the difference why class was central in the struggle for women's rights. The liberation struggle of working class women cannot be, as it is for the bourgeois women, a struggle against the men of her own class. Hand in hand with the men of her own class, the working class woman fights against capitalist society. The history of the WSPU and the lives of the Pankhurst women themselves shows the two sides of the struggle for women's right to vote. It was a central and important struggle, but its achievements revealed the limits of political equality when it is not connected to the wider fight for social and economic change. History shows us that for working class women and men to win equality in a society driven by class division takes a fight by the entire working class. Women organising alone across class lines will soon find out that the fundamental interests of one woman contradicts another. The suffragettes did not really campaign for votes for women, they campaigned for a minority of women's rights to vote. So while today women do have the right to vote in most places, this has not brought an end to oppression. We still have to fight for progressive change, to defend and extend abortion rights, for equal pay, still for same-sex marriage, against sexism. But we also must set our sights higher than reform. The system must be overthrown to win a truly equal society for women and men. The struggle for the right to vote is an inspiring one, but more importantly, it is instructive to those of us fighting for women's rights today. Society is not divided along the lines of gender, race, or sexuality. It is divided by class. We must get rid of the system that creates inequality and oppression, and the fight for reform plays an important role in that struggle.